You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Eli.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, which, as I never tire of saying, is available on both streaming video and audio podcast. I'm sure, Eli, you rarely go an hour without checking The Wright Show podcast feed.
No, I listen. I'm a big podcast listener, and you are on my
diet. Am I? Am I on your feed?
I pick and choose, but I
No, there won't be a test. Don't worry. I'm not gonna.
Pod library.
If you had a podcast, Eli, you would be.
Well, thank you.
On my smartphone. But as it happens, you're just on my computer. So let me introduce you. You're Eli Lake. Did I say that? You are a columnist for Bloomberg View.
Correct.
Very well-known journalist in Washington.
We're now Bloomberg Opinion. We just changed it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of a new redesign, but basically it's the same thing.
All else remains the same?
Yeah.
David Shipley still running the show?
Yes, your former New Republic colleague.
Yes, wonderful guy.
Yeah.
So you write mainly about foreign policy, it's fair to say, foreign affairs.
Yeah.
We're going to talk, for starters, about Iran, which has been much in the news, and about which you and I tend to have contrasting views, shall we say?
I would say that, yeah.
I think I view Iran as a less problematic player than you do, and accordingly believe we should be nicer to them than you believe we should be.
I think that's a fair, I like that, yes.
So, a lot has been happening. Of course, Trump blew up the arduously negotiated nuclear deal some time ago. Now, did you have an official position on that? Were you against the deal?
Well, I was very critical of the deal, but I wrote a few columns before, as we were waiting for that decision, saying that Trump would be wise not to withdraw, but to let it ride, because I thought it created enough uncertainty, and there are other external factors that had nothing to do with Trump, as to that there wasn't this gold rush of investment into Iran, so that in some ways, you know, he was getting the best of both worlds. You weren't seeing a lot of new capital coming into Iran, but the Iranians were complying, you know, with the terms of the deal. So I was like, well, why blow it up? And he also managed to get, and this is important, the European states, particularly the French, to agree to a kind of negotiation on things that would make it a stronger deal. And I thought, well, that would be worth playing out. So I had written a few columns along those lines.
Okay. So he blew that up. Lately, there have been a series of events that have led more and more people to talk about the Trump administration's goal in Iran, perhaps being regime change, things that have led people to speculate about the possibility of war with Iran, even the possibility of a wag the dog scenario where Trump foments conflict before November that is politically convenient in terms of getting people to rally around the flag, stave off the prospect of the Republicans losing the lower house, maybe. Who knows? These are the kinds of things that are in the air. And I mean, just quickly, the reason they're in the air, I guess, is Trump not only kind of blew up the Iran deal, but they're taking pretty forceful measures to keep other parties from doing business with Iran. In other words, it's not just that we are going to start respecting the sanctions again. We're talking about sanctioning companies like everywhere, I guess, who don't respect the sanctions that were in place before the deal. Anyway, I don't know if I have all that right, but certainly the idea is to apply economic pressure very forcefully. Meanwhile, Mike Pompeo gave a much publicized speech in which he talked about various problems he has with the regime, including the record on human rights, on corruption, you know, on in his view, fomenting terrorism and things like that. And the surmise is kind of that the administration is very much trying to stir the pot domestically, that some people in the administration would like to see Iranians rise up and overthrow the regime, after which presumably good things would happen. I'm not sure why they're so confident of that, but of either thing, the rising up or the good things happening. And of course, historically, both Pompeo and John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, have embraced at one time or another in their past the idea of regime change in Iran, right?
All right, well, let me start backwards. I mean, on the point about what are secondary sanctions, so not just barring Iran from the American markets, which, by the way, they were barred under the Iran deal, largely, that it would be penalizing European banks or insurance companies that did deals with Iran as well. That is what it means to reimpose those crippling sanctions. So the withdrawing from the Iran deal means that the sanctions that were suspended by the U.S., which, because we're the most powerful economy, affects everybody else because they are these secondary sanctions, that means that, they would be reimposed. And right now, the plan is that you would have a deadline, I think, of the first week in November for everybody to comply with that. And at least to date, there's no discussion of carve-outs or extensions or exemptions or anything like that. And we're already starting to see some allies or putative allies like Turkey saying that they do not intend to adhere to the sort of reimposed sanctions. So that's the first part. So I agree with you that it is very punitive, but that's what it means to get out of the Iran deal.
So you're saying, let me be clear. So by secondary sanctions, we mean we not only are ourselves respecting the sanctions on Iran, we're not doing business, not buying their oil, blah, blah, blah. And we not only kind of expect other parties to do that, but if they fail to do it, then we impose these secondary sanctions on them. We attack people who fail to economically attack Iran, to put it in
barred from America. Yeah, they'd be barred.
Right. And you're saying that all of those secondary sanctions actually were part of the pre-deal infrastructure?
Well, if you remember, I mean, a little bit of history, but there was a period, I'd say, from 2011 to 2013 where the Obama administration, with the prodding of Congress, went along with what are known as these crippling sanctions. And that mainly said that any country that was purchasing Iranian oil had to stop, and you couldn't ship Iranian oil, and you had to, and then ultimately their central bank could not participate in the world banking system. Well, the reason why the U.S. had the leverage to do that was because the way the sanctions work is that any other country or bank that did that kind of business would be barred effectively from the U.S. economy. And so if you're a major insurer or you're a major bank, it's not really a choice between Iran's economy and America's economy. So that's kind of the logic of it. Although what the Obama people would tell you and other nonpartisan types would say is that it also took quite a bit of diplomacy to make those sanctions work. And so those sanctions were kind of eased a bit in 2013 when the negotiations formally began, although we know that there were some talks beforehand. And then after the 2015 deal, and once it was implemented in the beginning of 2016, those sanctions were, I guess you'd say, suspended, because they still kind of were on the books in the U.S., mm-hmm. but we were no longer enforcing them. And that then created what I thought would happen, which would be a kind of new gold rush into Iran, where they'd see a lot more of this international investment. But it turns out that didn't really happen, despite, the sort of last year of the Obama administration encouraging that kind of thing. So what now has happened is that now the U.S. is out of that deal. Yeah. The Iranians, I should say, are still trying to preserve it in some ways with Europe, China, and Russia. But now there's this question of, the U.S. now will go back to imposing these sanctions, which, again, because we're the biggest economy, we have that leverage. So I think that's what's happening.
Right. And the reason this might not be seen as like a warranted kind of thing for the United States to do, I think, is that, there were unilateral U.S. sanctions, and I guess there were unilateral U.S. secondary sanctions, but there was also, there were U.N. sanctions, right? And then there had been a big, and we got everybody on board, kind of. I mean, China was on board, Russia was on board, the EU was on board. So these were pretty widely respected sanctions. And then we used them to get this deal with Iran, and then Iran did not violate the deal. They had been adhering to it, and then all of a sudden Trump said, "Well, screw you anyway." So you can understand how all of these other international players, Russia, China, Europe, they're part of the negotiations. They're like, they respected the sanctions. We got the deal. And now from their point of view, we are telling this. So their inclination is, look, Iran is still complying with the deal. Even though Trump is withdrawn, Iran has not said they're going to quit complying with it. So from their point of view, as long as Iran complies, they want to be able to do business with Iran, And now we say, the U.S. says, nope, sorry, we are going to use our disproportionate economic power of our like banking system and everything to punish you, to punish your companies if they have the nerve to do business with Iran, even though Iran is adhering to the deal. You can understand how, from their point of view, this seems like not fair play, right?
Yeah, they've said that. I mean, I wouldn't dispute that they think it's unfair.
But you understand.
I would point out just a couple of things on this. One, this really should have been a treaty. And we've kind of had a lot of backsliding in modern American history, where both the treaty making and war making powers of Congress Congress has largely abdicated that. So this is an example of what really was a significant treaty, and yet, because of a kind of maneuver from Senator Bob Corker, they were able to avert the treaty clause, which would require a 2/3 majority to ratify the treaty. And so this gets back to a kind of really interesting moment about 6 months before the actual deal was finished, which was when Senator Tom Cotton got most Republicans to write a letter to the Supreme Leader saying, just so you know, if there is a Republican president, this, you may not have such a deal. And it was, you know, he was renounced at the time and, you know, interfering with the president's authority. But I thought he was speaking, it was a pretty prescient letter, in the sense that, you know, there were votes in Congress where there were majorities in both the Senate and the House that voted against the deal.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you that, you know, there's other states would be upset about it, but, I think that, you know, that was something that should have been considered. And in the future, when you have these kinds of understandings, and I would say it would apply to Trump if he gets any understanding with the North Koreans, Senate has to approve it as a treaty at a certain point. And that makes this thing more durable. And I think
that would have been great. That would have been great, but I think it would be pretty surprising if, like, the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese really kind of obsessed over that. Now, I mean, from their point of view, the U.S. government agreed to a deal. And it's like one thing if the U.S. government wants to say we're out of it, but for us to now punish them, Europe, Russia, China, because they are adhering to a deal with Iran that Iran is continuing to adhere to, and a deal that the U.S. government signed on to with congressional approval, even if not in the form of a treaty. You know, it's pretty mind-blowing. I mean, honestly. And
This is getting into a fairly technical thing, and I know that there are experts who would argue it both ways. But, you know, the fairly impressive cache of nuclear designs that were warehoused after the agreement, not just the Israelis, there are some experts who would say that that would sort of constitute a violation of the
deal. Oh, come on, Eli. That was all about behavior long before the deal, and it was behavior we knew about.
The violation being that, A, they never fully complied with the IAEA to give the full historical account of it, which, by the way, this archive does. But more importantly, they preserved, you know, these fairly detailed blueprints and so forth, which was an indication of that after the limits on producing nuclear fuel expired, which they do, that there was an effort to try to either restart the program or to weaponize or give them the option.
This is getting very technical. You're right. I mean, Israel says that they found these documents. And
it's not just Israel. I'm saying now there's recently some very good reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post, you know, that where they were able to look more at some of the stuff and talk to more experts. And it was fair. It was a pretty comprehensive archive on how to build a nuclear weapon, which a capability they preserve.
Well, of course,
the argument that they right. they were that there was because of the time limits on it,
right?
Which,
and you're right. I don't think we should spend a lot of time on this, but we knew. In fact, this is why there was the urgency. You know, that the part of the impetus for the whole talks that led to the deal was. We knew that in the past they had been trying to develop the weapon. There was good reason to believe that, and that's what these documents fundamentally substantiated. The fact that they were sitting in a warehouse, you know, suggests to me that maybe it wasn't on the front burner to actually develop the weapons. In any event, let's be clear. This is unprecedentedly, I think, intrusive system of monitoring and inspection that was confirming continued Iranian compliance with the deal, and even Trump isn't complaining. They weren't fundamentally complying with the deal. So let me ask you a question.
Other issue of access to military sites, which was ambiguous, but at least precedent when there was an effort to try to go to a military site known as Parchin, that they would not allow the IAEA inspectors actually to visit the site, which a lot of people thought was, you know, a weakness in the deal itself. And, you know,
okay. If it's a weakness in the deal, then it's a weakness in the deal as opposed to noncompliance. In any event, even Trump is not really saying the reason for all this is that they're not complying. Let's get to the current. Let's cut to kind of the present. So now, it's interesting. The Pompeo speech focused largely on kind of human rights issues, corruption. Like, we want the Iranian government to clean up its act internally. And you agree that that should be a big area of focus. There's, of course, a second set of concerns that I think for some players in the regions, like Israel, is much more important. And that is Iran's external behavior in Syria. They have, proxies and some actual Iranian troops in Syria with the permission of the Syrian government. Syria's an ally. I gather you think that Iran needs to change on both of those fronts, external behavior and internal behavior. And if they don't, I mean, we should keep the economic strangulation up. Is that your position?
Well, I am in favor of a certain kind of a sanction, which is aimed at separating the leadership from the population, similar to what we have in Russia known as the Magnitsky Act, which would make it impossible for Iranian figures that are designated to travel or to hold bank accounts. I'm for all kinds of what I have. My approach, which is not currently the Trump administration policy that I favor, is what I would just call sort of a solidarity approach, which is that America is not and won't be and can't be the author of the next Iranian revolution, but we should open our eyes and see that it is a country that there is great dissatisfaction at multiple segments of their society with the failure of their current regime, mm-hmm. and that if we should try to empower them, and I would favor a kind of efforts to have a diplomatic channel to leading. I mean, there isn't a kind of hierarchical Iranian opposition at this point, so it's a little difficult, but I would favor as much sort of diplomacy with that. And I would say the U.S. government's job is to try to do as much as it can, not to punish the Iranian population, but to punish the regime, which the Iranian people dislike. And then the Iranian people should be the lead in taking their country back at this point. And I've done a bit of writing on this. I think the reform movement is dead. And, that is not the fault of the reformers. It's the fault of the people who keep arresting them and killing them. So at this point, I don't want any deals with the Iranians. My concern is that as Trump says himself many times, he does want to deal with the regime. And he believes that all these tactics that they're doing right now, all the pain that he's causing, mm-hmm. are tactics to get them to the negotiating, similar to what we saw with North Korea, where, you know, we all remember Crazy Rocket Man and inviting mm-hmm. the dissidents to the State of the Union, only to find, you know, that what I found a sickening display in Singapore, where you had the President of the United States, you know, saying that, you know, this tyrant in North Korea was beloved by his people, which is a lie. Yeah. So my view is that I'm afraid that that's probably what Trump's thinking. He says it himself. I think Tom Pompeo takes a tougher line. I think you're right, Bolton takes a tougher line. I want to make this very clear to all of the Blogging Heads viewers and listeners out there and to you, and I have said it many times, any notion that the U.S. should support or arm or fund the Mujahideen Khalq, a.k.a. the MEK, is a fantasy. The MEK is not a legitimate opposition. They are a kind of cult-like organization. If they were to agree to a level of kind of pluralism, they can be one of many factions, I would think, inside of a kind of large, broad sort of coalition of people who don't like the current regime. But they claim to be the only voice of it. So that's always a bad move. I don't agree with that.
Yeah, MEK, we should say, for a long time, it was on our terrorism list because they had actually killed Americans.
They had killed Americans.
But they were embraced by some Iran opponents, including some who had gotten huge speaking fees from them, ranging from Howard Dean to some people who are in the Trump administration. I think either Pompeo or Bolton.
Bolton has spoken. I don't know how much he's gotten.
He's gotten a fee from them. MEK, we're in solidarity on that, Eli. MEK, not to be not to be embraced.
But I want to say that when people talk about helping the Iranian opposition, they usually say, "Oh, you mean helping the MEK?" No, I mean the op. I mean, there, and there really is. We saw it in December and January, but it wasn't some blip. I mean, there are still these demonstrations that don't, you know, they're not as big a news story as they were 7 months ago, but they're still there. And it is an internal process, but I do think the regime is in, has a, what would be called a legitimation crisis.
Okay, but why should we apply economic pressure to them to change their domestic political situation if we're emphatically not applying that kind of pressure to various other countries who have at least as problematic domestic situations, including a number of our close allies? Well, like Saudi Arabia and Egypt. I mean, what is the – I don't understand how this is a coherent policy or what business we have doing this.
Okay, so there are two answers to that. The economic pressure on Iran is not really there to address the deficits in their system that we're talking about, human rights and corruption. That's not what that's about. This is about, as I said, pressuring the regime, similar to what Obama did in that period of 2011 to say 2013, to eventually come to negotiate and submit to better terms on their nuclear program, and also I would add their regional aggression.
That's something I don't want to pass over lightly. I want to get back to what you're calling regional aggression, but you're right.
I want to make it clear, like you're talking about this kind of economic pressure or crippling sanctions. That is part of a policy that is not designed to topple the regime. That is a policy that's designed to pressure the regime to again submit to better terms. My policy would be to take this approach that would have everything that the U.S. did in terms of sanctions or anything else designed to sort of expose the corruption of the regime and so forth and everything else. And you want to ask, why do you want a kind of democratic revolution in Iran and not a democratic revolution in Saudi Arabia? And in Egypt is a little bit different because I'm no fan of Sisi and have been pretty critical of him over the years too. But
did you oppose the coup? Did you say that the U.S. should have stepped in to kind of keep them from, which the U.S. probably could have done, could have stopped that coup? Was your view at the time, your stated view, that they shouldn't do that?
Well, I am now like fully on the opinion side, but at the time when I was working with my former writing partner, Josh Rogan, we covered that and we wrote a number of stories about the inconsistencies and kind of hypocrisy that we have all these rules and laws on the books that say we can't give military aid to a government that, you know, from a military coup, and how the Obama administration was not doing that. But I would also say that, you know, we have to be somewhat attuned to the fact that Morsi was taking a number of steps that expand and almost, I think, and enshrine
the elected rule. President who was deposed.
Morsi was the elected president of Egypt, no doubt about that.
Right.
But in the 11 months of his presidency, he, you know, not only fired judges, but he specifically meddled and changed the dynamic of a constitution.
Anyway, back to why.
He also let out a lot of jihadists from jail. There's a lot of things that he did that were unpopular in Egypt. That does not mean that we should, that I think, by the way, I would argue that, you know, people on the right should be wary that, you know, what appears to be this great success of the Sisi regime, I mean, it's built on sand, because at a certain point, all of these sorts of dictatorships will end up, you won't see it coming, but he's not eradicated the Islamist threat in Egypt.
Some people on the right were, in my view, good on this issue and opposed the coup. I think maybe even Bob Kagan did, but in any event, the Obama administration.
And Elliot Abrams definitely did.
What's that?
Elliot Abrams and Bob Kagan did, yes.
Okay. Good. So, in any event, Obama countenanced the coup And I think that was a mistake.
Back to your point. I mean, we get this. I get this a lot. And the answer is that I like human rights for universal reasons, and I like, you know, open societies for universal reasons. So I support open societies, you know, everywhere, including in U.S. allies. Right. But the reason why I think it's a strategic import is because Iran, is still, you know, an enemy of us and our friends in the region. It's not just, we used to argue about this when it was going on, but it's not just the, you know, IEDs that they're responsible for in Iraq and Iran. It's their expansionist foreign policy, whether it's in Lebanon, Syria, or in Yemen. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons why I think that there is at least a potential to get a wider coalition to support what I would call a sort of solidarity with Iranian freedom movement policy approach is because, you know, the Iranians were, along with Russia, the principal allies that enabled a ghastly crime from the Assad regime against his own people. So you pointed out earlier, you said, oh, well, you know, the Iranians were invited into Syria, and they were invited into Syria by a tyrant who was butchering his own population. And
we deport some of those tyrants, and we oppose some, and it gets back to my question, what is the criteria?
I'm not denying that there's, I mean, we always talk about this, American foreign policy is...
Well, I think it's fair to ask for some...
It's
fair to either ask for some consistency of principle as we apply it to other countries, or at least a clear explanation of what the carve-outs are, and I haven't heard that yet so far as Iran goes.
It's hard that Iran is arrayed in every possible way against our interests, whereas Saudi Arabia and Egypt, to use those two examples, are not. Allies of the United States. Iran is an enemy of the United States.
Oh, wait. Now, come on. You think Iran is actually a military threat to the United States?
Iran is an enemy of the United States. Yes.
Well, Iran, look. Well, for people who don't know, the U.S. sponsored a coup in 1953 in Iran that unseated a democratically elected president, led to a very repressive, brutal dictator named the Shah of Iran. The 1979 revolution, which had a decidedly religious character and installed the current kind of series of, you know, current regime, so to speak, although the original Ayatollah is dead, obviously, naturally, not surprisingly, had a very anti-U.S. character. We had installed the guy who was exactly the kind of guy you would hate, I would think, right? We had installed him, so the regime developed as just a rhetorical flourish, kind of America is Satan kind of thing that has worked for them politically ever since. They keep saying it, but the idea that Iran is a meaningful threat to us is crazy. That's crazy. What could they do to us?
First of all, they are a meaningful threat.
What could they do to us?
We know that Iran was plotting, and this is not me, it's the Justice Department, as recently as, I guess, 2011, to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. at Cafe Malone.
I'm not sure the evidence is as good kind as your...
Defense Secretary said at the time, he said it was, we had the equivalent of the Zimmerman telegram linking the Iranians to that. So that's one of numerous...
They wanted to kill a Saudi ambassador on U.S. soil. That would not have been the end of our republic, assuming we could connect that to the Iranian regime, as opposed to various other actors in Iran.
Okay, first of all, it's not me who's connecting it to the Iranian regime.
Well, whatever. Again...
Department of Justice.
Okay, but...
Under Eric Holder.
Any country in the world, you know... could, in theory, sponsor terrorism in our soil. If Iran were bent on doing that, I assure you we would have seen some of it.
And Iran, we haven't seen any blowing up the U.S. Air Force.
Has there ever been a single instance of terrorism on American soil clearly sponsored directly by Iran, ever?
Well, thank God, you know, the Cafe Milano assassination didn't happen, but that would have one that, you know, but it's not just that. Listen, we can go on. This is not America, but it's, you know, the Israeli embassy, the Amiot Cultural Center in Buenos Aires, the Khobar Towers in the 1990s. There was most recently, the Iranians, Iranian nationals were arrested in Europe, for attempting, an assassination against the MEK. So when you say, do I think the Iranians will be responsible for a kind of red dawn in America like that movie from the 1980s? No, I don't. Do I think the Iranians are the Henry Ford of modern Islamic terrorism and use terrorism as a means of statecraft in Europe, America, South America, etc.? Yes, they do. So in that respect, it's a problem. But more importantly, it's also a problem to our allies in the Middle East, which are freaking out right now.
Eli, when Israel sponsors the assassination of scientists in Iran, as they did,
yes,
Iran sees that as terrorism, okay? And so there's a whole tit for tat going on here. In fact, you mentioned the Buenos Aires thing. My understanding is that the standard or a common speculation is that was Hezbollah retaliating for an Israeli assassination of Hezbollah people. And hey, I'm not condoning it, but it's horrible. But I'm saying that all of this stuff is in the context of a tit for tat in which we do certain things. Israel's committed various things that are by any balanced reckoning, violations of international law and or terrorism that involve killing a lot of Iranians. And there's just a whole history of this thing. And I don't know.
I'm aware that the Iranians see themselves in this kind of war, but I mean, I'm just
who doesn't? Who disagrees?
Iran is also like the great hostage-taking nation as well. And you know, it doesn't matter if you're in a Western journalist or Western businessman. They are, you know, the very definition of a rogue state. What's more, their current, you know, corrupt leadership, which is, I think, I would argue, despised by its people, hate America. They hate the United States. So I'm just saying we are where we are, Bob.
Eli, they are where we are. They are not.
What are you recommending? Do you recommend, you know,
the idea that they're the definition of a rogue state? I mean, first of all, in order to cite some actual terrorist acts that have been plausibly linked to them, in order to cite like more than three, you had to go back like 25 years. So
hold on, wait a second. If you want to count attacks against Israel, we could, there's far more.
Oh, let's do talk about that. Absolutely. Yeah. Because okay. Israel has repeatedly attacked Iranian troops and or proxies in Syria, a clear-cut violation of international law, actually killed people. Iran has retaliated, like, what, once or twice? Israel has done that every month in recent months, killed actual Iranians in Syria.
It's a little bit different. Israel has at times for a few years until recently specifically hit what their red line was, convoys of advanced weapons that Hezbollah was sending into Lebanon that could hit their cities, which I think is...
They get to define their red laws. It's illegal under international law, Eli. Iran was in Syria with the permission of the Syrian government. It is an act of aggression by any reckoning in international law.
I just think this is crazy, Jock. I mean, I think that the Israelis... When the Israelis hitting Quds Force positions in Syria, and I hope it deters them or, you know, really screws them up. But, I mean, it's a humanitarian act. The Iranians are responsible it's a humanitarian act, yes.
It's definitely taking some lives. Whose life is it saving?
The lives of the Syrians who will not be slaughtered by Iranians because there'll be fewer there.
First of all, this has been happening.
Are you aware of the siege of Aleppo? Did you follow that story?
That's not what the Israeli interventions were about. Come on, Eli. Eli, that's not what the Israeli interventions were about.
No, wait a second, Bob. If you can do anything to weaken or deter the Iranian Quds Force in Syria after what they have been responsible for, then I think that's a humanitarian gesture. Why, you should be thanking the Israelis.
Well, first of all,
you should also be thanking Vladimir Putin, because Vladimir Putin allowed the Israelis to hit those Iranian positions because he controls the skies in Syria. Now, for you to just sort of I think it's a very thin reed to say, well, the Syrian government invited them in. The Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad, who's responsible for what? 500,000 civilians who are dead. Have you seen the ways in which they were killed? Not just the chemical weapons.
Eli, if you want to go back.
From their prisons. Have you seen any of that? And then you here are worried about the loss of the lives of the Iranian Quds Force. This is crazy.
No, I am totally
crazy. You have to have some.
I am totally concerned about the massive loss of life in Syria. Mm-hmm. And I think in retrospect, I mean, two things. First of all, the Israeli interventions we're talking about, a lot of them have happened since the outcome of the Civil War there was decided. It's over. You can't depict these things as trying to turn the tide of the Civil War. Anyone who tried to turn the tide of the Civil War at this point would be ensuring that more people are killed, okay?
I think that anything to drive Iran out of Syria is a good thing.
Well, of course you do, because you're looking at it from Israel's perspective.
I'm not arguing that it's better if you do it through airstrikes. I mean, ideally, it would be great if they just woke up tomorrow and realized they're demoralized, they'll never win, and pack up and go home. But that doesn't happen. This is, I mean, you said earlier it was a kind of war. Now, what are the Israelis doing? What the Israelis are doing is that they cannot have the Iranians on their border. They've made that very clear to the Russians, and the Russians have said, all right, if you want to hit them, you can go ahead and do that. I mean, I don't want the Iranians on their border either. But so I mean,
what if Syria says the same thing? We can't stand to have Iranian troops on our border, and we're going to hit them. Can they do that? My point, Eli, is this. The reason I keep coming back to actual international law is because you just can't have a world in which every country does what Israel is doing and says, we're making the rules, and the rules are not reciprocal. Sorry. We get to decide who we attack around here. And if anybody around here decides that they want to attack us, in other words, does in mirror image what we're doing to them, tough luck.
When did your world of like international law governing the behavior of states ever exist? Never existed.
Well, respect for it.
Of international law. Now, the best that we can hope for is that the U.S., you know, when it does things, will make it a point to go to the U.N. Security Council and so forth. But it is that institution, that train has left the building. And if you want to talk about violations of international law, there are a lot of violations of international law that are right there in Syria that I think are far more serious. Or for that matter, you could just go through the list. Who invited the Iranians into Yemen? Who told the Iranians it was okay to send missiles into Yemen that can hit the international airport in Riyadh? Are the Saudis supposed to then wait and say, wait a second, it's against international law if we attack Yemen, so.
Eli, if the Saudis hadn't started,
that's what I'm saying.
Eli, if the Saudis hadn't started bombing Yemen, no missile would have ever gone from Yemen into Saudi Arabia. Give me a break. You keep forgetting. You keep starting the clock right now.
For overthrowing that particular government. So, I mean, if you're talking about violations of international law, you have the great international law violator in Tehran. I mean, let's apply it to that. My point, though,
Israel has violated as much international law as Tehran, for sure. I mean, I'm not even getting into the occupied territories and the illegal settlements. I mean, the idea that Iran has violated international law more than other players in the region, or even as much as all of them, is just not sustainable. International law, I'm talking about, things that you would disapprove of, or even things I would disapprove of.
They aided and abetted a genocide in Syria, and they're just another player in the region. What are the Iranians responsible? The Iranians are responsible for supporting the militias in Iraq that were going house to house. You know, and this is the thing. It's like you have to distinguish between America, which is generally what we were doing in Iraq, is totally different than what the Iranians were doing in Iraq.
So wait.
What the Iranians were doing in Syria was basically providing, a weak Hitler with enough backup so he could survive. And congratulations, Assad has survived because of Iran. I mean, I don't know. What are you even talking about here? Iran has total disregard. They don't care about international law. That's not how they operate.
We've certainly violated. They have probably violated it.
This happens, then we'll have a terror. We're already in that world where nobody cares about internet.
That world is not sustainable. That world is not sustainable. If we don't cultivate respect for rules of the road, really bad things are going to happen.
I'm glad you said that. I agree with you. I would like a functioning international system. Bob, you're right. I'd like a world where.
But you don't want to make the first move toward it.
No, I think there is a first move toward it. And I think that,
what is that move?
Well, I think we have to, if I could quote, there's an old police song called One World is Enough for All of Us. You remember that? It's from, Adam and Data. Anyway, Sting was wrong. We have to have an international system that has you know, there's one system, I think, for countries that respect the rule of law and are what I would consider open societies. And I would be willing to sort of fudge and saying, oh, if you're not, if you're transitioning to democracy or something, but there's one system for that. There's another system for your Chinas, your Russias, your Irans, your North Koreas, your countries that are only interested in spoiling or undermining an international system. And that's how I would, that's where I would start. It really goes back to Immanuel Kant.
You understand that you can make the case that America or Israel is as problematic as Iran. Don't you get that?
I'm not.
What about the Stuxnet attack on Iran? A cyber attack that actually blew stuff up. What about, you know, you can go on all day with this stuff.
If there was like a Nobel Prize for peace through cybersecurity, I would give it to the Israeli and American engineers for the Stuxnet attack.
For Stuxnet.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It wasn't enough because obviously,
it was aimed at Iran's nuclear program, even though it wasn't at that point, so far as we know, devoted to building a bomb. It was just nuclear research. But let me ask you this. So let's talk about the whole premise of the nuclear deal. I think it was a great deal, but, you know, it's interesting that we thought we kind of had the right to tell Iran they couldn't develop nuclear weapons because, after all, they could just do what Israel did, which is say, Israel just wasn't part of the non-proliferation treaty, so they developed nuclear weapons and it wasn't a violation of the treaty. Iran had the option of leaving the NPT, the treaty, at any point, developing nuclear weapons. It would have had exactly the same status as Israel. I gather your view is that Israel should be allowed to develop nuclear weapons, other countries shouldn't be allowed to.
Well, at this point, Israel should be allowed to possess nuclear weapons because they do possess them.
And then if Iran already had them, we'd say, okay, cool. Or North Korea already has them, we'd say, okay, cool.
Iran is sort of counting on that. The reason why that there's a you could argue maybe a double standard for Iran is because they're run by a bunch of fanatical anti-American.
Well, Pakistan, India, same situation. I wouldn't call Pakistan a pillar of stability.
I don't think Pakistan should be allowed to possess a nuclear weapon, but again, they already have one. So that's, you know, I mean, you're identifying, you know, the great challenge of non-proliferation is that we don't want to be forced with that choice with Iran, so we'd like to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon.
Right, and so they agreed to this deal that kept them from, you know, getting one. But I won't go there.
I would argue they agreed to a deal that limited their ability to make nuclear fuel for a kind of 10 to 20 year period, various elements of it, and gave a lot of transparency to their declared program.
Yeah.
But the concern that the Israelis had, and frankly, I think anyone, and even I mean, like after they left government, there are many Obama people. I wrote a column about it. But that said, like, hey, you know, the time limits are a problem on that deal because eventually they have to deal with it. As I said at the beginning of our discussion here, my view was that, you know, let it ride. And because I think that there are a lot of reasons why people don't want to invest in Iran right now, that start with the legitimacy question, which I think is a far more poignant one with them. But, you know, so we are where we are. It's like, I'm not going to be your stand-in for the Trump administration on everything because there's so many things where I disagree with what the president does on foreign policy. But, of course, I mean, and by the way, you mentioned earlier, I think, you know, Israel assassinating scientists in Iran, and I think there were 5 or 6 that they did.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you'd have to recognize that the prospect of the Iranians having a nuclear weapon was something that the Israelis could not live with, so they defended themselves.
Israelis
would feel like a little bit specifically like why the Israelis would maybe feel really uncomfortable with that idea, right?
So when any given country finds something threatening in another country, they should be able to assassinate people in that country, or is it just? I mean. I really think it's important that we have rules of the road that people comply with, and you know, I mean, the assassin. Anyway, let me say one thing.
But to your question, you know, that's one of the big problems that, you know, I mean, the Iranian regime being itself such a serial violator of international norms.
I don't agree that it's any worse than any number of countries in the other region.
I can't understand why you would say that. It's really baffling to me that you think that they're no better or worse than Israel in terms of, that's just nuts, I think.
Just in terms of quantity of violation of international law, I think you'd find if you really wrote it down on paper, it's far from clear that Iran has done more of it than Israel and possibly than other countries in the region.
Campaigns in Europe in the 1990s.
I should say, by the way, or America. I mean, America's pretty bad about international law and has been. I mean, I can list a number of it. The Iraqi invasion violated international law. Once the Libyan intervention morphed from protection of civilians to regime change, that violated international law. Kosovo, I think, violated international law, no Security Council authorization. So America is probably worse than either Israel or Iran. I mean, in terms of quantity and magnitude of like clear-cut violations of international law, and we should say that, you know, international law was built up in the wake of World War II with a lot of actual emphasis on national sovereignty. The emphasis originally was on preventing trans-border aggression. And the basic idea is we don't let countries meddle in the internal affairs of other countries. We're trying to prevent war. We're not trying to prevent oppression. That's not what international law was really about from the outside. You would like it to be more about preventing oppression. It has evolved somewhat in that direction. That's all true. But, this leads me to one thing I want to say about Syria quickly. I mean, you're right. Assad is a terrible person who's done terrible things. I personally think, I think it's clear that, let me just say, I think we and our allies made things a lot worse in Syria than they had to be. There was a protest movement that was brutally suppressed by Assad, ruthlessly suppressed, in horrible ways. I think that was probably going to be about the end of it had arms not started flowing into Syria, largely from us and our allies. So I think we turned this into a full-fledged, massive civil war that led to hundreds of thousands, I guess, of deaths. What, a million? You tell me how many refugees. It's been a disaster. And I think that was clearly an intervention in the affairs of another country that I'm not sure that was a violation of international law. But I think what it leads me to say is the following. You're right. Assad's horrible. It's clear that Sisi in Egypt, whom we support, is just as horrible because we know what happened when, after the coup that put him in power, Egyptian citizens protested peacefully, not even remotely near any kind of armed protest. His men just gunned hundreds of them down, killed them. So we can say safely that if somebody had funneled in arms to support them, he would have done things just as ruthless as what Assad did. But then we'd be on the other side of the story. We'd be against the people who were funneling the arms in, because this is our ruthless dictator. And you know,
I don't know why you have to twist and bend over backwards. I'm not going to defend Sisi's mass.
What am I twisting?
Killing of peaceful protesters. I don't defend, you know, even what he did in large part to the Muslim Brotherhood, even though I'm not a big fan of the Muslim Brotherhood. And as you know, I lived in Egypt for a period, so I'm not, you know, like. I don't understand this tendency to want to say he's just as bad as Assad. He's not just as bad as Assad because Assad really did kill by
order. No, but it's clear Sisi would have done that had somebody funneled in arms to the opposition. He clearly is a guy who will stop at nothing. I mean, actually, that thing he did with his civilians, killing those civilians, that's as bad as anything Assad did before the insurgency became armed.
I have to say that given what Assad has actually done, and I would urge the viewers and listeners to go back to the headlines from 2 years ago in the siege of Aleppo. That is Assad, Russia.
Oh, sure. No, he did horrible things.
Given what it done. And
once
so
it became a civil war.
A lot of people would have said the same
thing. I don't deny that. Yeah.
So a lot of people would have said the same thing about Hosni Mubarak, but eventually Hosni Mubarak, in fact, did step down under American pressure because American, the U.S. government has enormous amount of leverage it does not have with Syria. Now, the U.S. government also, I think, was half in, half out when it came to kind of stealthily intervening in Syria, where there was a Pentagon program, a CIA program, and then what the real issue was that American allies in the region supported the opposition to Assad, and in some cases, some very bad actors, obviously, we know ISIS and al-Nusra, right, and these others, began to sort of take hold, and it became too much of a pretty thorny question. And even though I'm critical of Obama, there is a fair argument that his administration makes after the fact that in 2012 and 2013, would intervening against Assad have resulted in empowering ISIS, which was right then beginning to sort of ramp up. And in 2014, 2015, you start to see the attacks in Europe and, you know, was effectively kind of tying our hands. And given the fact that Obama was pretty clear, he didn't want to send in American forces and the, you know, levels that would have been needed to secure those areas, he ended up sort of doing nothing. Now, I would say the wages of that not decision to sort of half-assed intervene or not really intervene or non-intervention, you know, we're going to be paying for generations. But I would also say that in that moment of 2012, 2013, to be fair, it was a very messy and complicated situation. But when it comes to the venality of Assad, let's not try to compare him or his patrons really to others. I mean, it's really a huge difference, even though I agree with you that Sisi's
not. Well, comparing to what Sisi has actually done, that's true. But it's pretty clear if Sisi faced an actual civil war.
Well, yeah, like I said, there's people might have thought that Mubarak would have done the same thing, and yet Mubarak eventually, you know, sat down. And also you have to ask the question of, would his military have complied? The reason that Mubarak is no longer the dictator of Egypt is because his military did not comply in Tahrir Square. So it's just a point to keep in mind that even though you're right, Sisi's a pretty bad guy. Now, in the case of Assad, mm-hmm. it was a, you know,
well,
he had international lawbreakers, Iran and Russia coming in.
I assume
in.
You'll at a minimum agree with this. The civil war is basically over. Assad is still in power. We are in a worse place. It would have been better if we had not, and our allies, and it was largely our allies at the beginning, funneled the arms in and gotten all these additional people killed and created all these additional refugees. That would actually be a better world, because Assad's in power either way. I assume you'll agree with that, right? If those however many people were still alive and those however many people who are refugees were not refugees, that would be a better world. Assad's in power either way. In retrospect, arming them did not work out well. You'd agree with that?
I disagree. I think a better world would have been if Assad at a certain moment realized that in order to sort of escalate his own attacks on his own civilians, maybe the, you know, the first sort of real mass casualty stuff that he caused, that he didn't do it because, you know, he was afraid that if he had, you know.
I agree. That would be a better world. But the question sure. I presented that you yeah. said you disagree with. So in saying you disagree that the option we pursued is worse than the option I outlined where he just stays in power, we don't arm them. In saying you disagree.
First of all, I don't think it's okay. So let me just say, I'm a big believer in American exceptionalism and American power. In 2013, I don't know that Obama had said, we're going to end all of our programs, or 2012, we're not going to arm the Assad opposition, that would have meant that Saudi Arabia and Qatar and United Arab Emirates and Turkey were going to comply. In fact, we know that they didn't comply because the United States was kind of urging them, like, you know, maybe back off a little bit and, you know, after the Assad must go stuff. And they didn't. They escalated. So sometimes things are out of our control.
That's true.
And so that's another point.
That's true. I just said hypothetically, yeah. if we and our allies had not flooded Syria with weapons, and we did wind up playing a big role in that, would we not be in a better place? Assad would be in power. He's in power now. A whole bunch of people would be alive and not refugees, who now are either dead or are refugees. And there's all this residue of, like, in fact, you have all these Iranian troops and proxies that you don't want in Syria, many of whom would not be there had the civil war not progressed. So wouldn't that be a better place?
I mean, Bob, you're asking me to sort of, I mean, wouldn't it have been a better place if the United States had shown a lot of force early on and that,
you know, no, those are not, it's my thought experiment, Eli. I'll tell you what, I'll let you give me a thought experiment afterwards, but I promise to just answer it straightforwardly. I'm just saying, if I give you these two options, which is better?
I think knowing that, you know, we weren't prepared to arm and train his opposition to the point where we would have, A, created a sort of space that wasn't Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and B, we had a force strong enough to take out Assad, that we should have done more. I think, I guess my argument is like, we should have intervened more, But if you're giving me a choice between, should we have done zero intervention, let Assad win, we would have a shorter civil war, but Assad would still be in power.
My question is not if was either of those your preferred option. My question is, suppose in this thought experiment that I'm constructing, those are the only two possible universes. Which would you
choose? Two possible universes, and like, please do not take this out of context. Are that you extended the civil war versus a quick win for Assad. I'd have to be a moral monster not to want a shorter war with the tyrant remaining in place. But as again, I don't think those are the two options. So there you go.
I'm going to cut out the part where you said, but again, I don't think those are the two options. Right. And we're going to take this out of context. And in any event, we're ending on a note of concord, but we're not ending. We can talk about other stuff. You know, quickly on Iran, just what do you think the chances are of actual war?
I think that what we're learning with Trump is that there's a lot of bluster and hyperbole that is often, and I think that he's said this explicitly. I've read like Robin Wright and other people who've said that this is really a regime change thing. And I think if this was like a normal presidency, it's such an abnormal presidency that there would be something to it, because there's certainly Bolton and is a regime changer when it comes to Iran, at least when he was out of government. But Trump presidency is not a presidency that you can really analyze through the lens of, well, let's look at the past heritage speeches from James Mattis to figure out what our position on NATO expansion is going to be. Because that's not how it works. It's, as we just saw with the Helsinki stuff. So he constantly says this, and it seems he says, one, I know they're going to have a lot of pain and consequences like they've never seen, but I think after some time they could come back and we could strike a deal, because he loves negotiating deals. That's what Trump likes to do.
This is your fear.
If he wants to negotiate a better nuclear deal with the Iranians, it's fine. My concern is that I just think that, as I said, a policy of American solidarity with the Iran freedom movement should not be negotiable. Reagan managed to negotiate all kinds of things with Gorbachev, or he managed to participate in negotiations with Gorbachev while still being a real hard ass when it came to, like, you know, Soviet dissidents and refuseniks and so forth. I would prefer a similar policy with Iran, with the caveat that, of course, Iran does not have the reach, strength and power of the evil empire that the Soviet Union in those days did. But I think that Iran is a regional power, and a regional power that, you know, as we talked about earlier, is hostile to the United States and its allies. But if you want to negotiate, I don't know, any number of things, you know, their exit from Syria or better terms for stopping their development of long-range missiles or any number of things, if you want to negotiate that, that's fine. What I'm concerned about is that as part of just getting those negotiations to begin with, we will no longer see the kinds of speeches that I like from people like Pompeo that point to the corruption and abuses of their leadership. I would finally say this, and I think it's very important. The dynamic in Iran is Iranian. I don't know that there's a lot that, I mean, I think it's important to have solidarity from the outside world in the West. And I'd like to certainly do as much as we can. But I think that the main actors in this are going to be, you know, the people who are organizing the various strikes, the women who are taking off their hijabs in public, the people who are figuring out how to use the latest kind of, you know, VPN networks to use their telegrams and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's where we're going to find out who wins and loses. And I think in the end, I don't think that the regime can sustain. I'm not making a prediction, but I think over time, they're not going to be able to hold on to power. I think the Iranian people are sick of it. And it's not just the students, which we saw in 99 and 2009. It's so many other vast segments of the society at this point that are just sick of it that, you know, I think we will
find. I think what a lot of them are actually protesting is economic conditions for which we are partly responsible. I mean, Trump was actually undermining the economy long before he got out of the deal by sowing uncertainty about the consequences of relaxing the sanctions and actually doing business with Iran. But I'll tell you, I don't think they
would have gotten a lot of. I mean, the one reason why people are not investing in Iran, I mean, which is sort of the point I made in one of these my columns before he made the decision, is that there's so much sort of corruption and secrecy in their own economy. Plus, there is a bad tendency of occasionally just, you know, arresting various dual nationals who so many of these international corporations rely on to open doors for them. I mean, we should mention Sinemak Namazi and his father. So that kind of insanity that it happens in Iran is not very good for business. Plus, there's a lot of people, not just, American neoconservatives, like the Saudi royal family, for example, that really does see what the Iranians are doing to be such a threat to their, to them and their interests, that doing business with Iran, I think, not only cost you, obviously now doing business with America, but also Saudi and Israel and all these other powerful economies as well. So Iran is truly pretty isolated. And it's, I just think now is the moment where I would just appeal maybe to the Blogging Heads viewers that if you are, you know, a good anti-Trump liberal, and I understand that you don't like Trump, don't let that cloud your judgment on Iran. Join the movement to support the Iranian people and isolate that regime.
Let me tell you why I don't think you have to worry about a deal happening with Iran.
Right.
Trump, like, negotiating a deal. Where do I begin? For starters, you know, often opposition from an external power, like opposition from the United States, consolidates support for a regime. In this case, I think that that dynamic is, if anything, more pronounced because it's so easy to dislike Trump. So a number of Iranians who probably liked Obama don't like Trump.
There's a lot of Iranians who don't like Obama, by the way, and they don't like Obama precisely because of the nuclear deal, because they feel that he didn't put human rights on the agenda, that there were more
those are the Iranians you're talking about.
There's a lot of Iranians who don't like Obama.
Those are the Iranians that your people talk to. I would reiterate that
No.
Okay.
There's a lot of Iranians who are really in the struggle who don't. I know this because I actually wrote a column saying now's the chance for Obama to support the Iranian freedom movement because of exactly what you said. I got so much mail from not hardcore, you know, conservative types. I got from many Iranians who said we don't want to.
There definitely are a lot of Iranians who would like a more liberal political environment. There's no doubt about that. I do think you're kidding yourself if you think the protests are not to a non-trivial extent about economics and not political liberty.
I think they're about economics. I think they're about repression. I think they're also about the lack of drinking water, the ecological mismanagement.
But in any event,
I think it's just like, we're at the point now. They always end up saying death to the dictator. Iran for me, not Iran for Syria, not Iran for Hezbollah. They always say that. So the chant might start off with saying, what happened to our pensions? Why did this bank, you know, steal all of our money? But it always ends with death to the dictator.
Okay.
It's not that far from you know.
My argument about why you don't have to worry about a deal with Trump has more elements than this. But I do think you shouldn't underestimate the extent to which this will actually, Trump's opposition will consolidate the regime's power. And in fact, Rouhani, the president, as opposed to the supreme leader, has, since Trump, in the face of the recent opposition from America, including the famous tweet from Trump, Rouhani has been becoming he's been moving toward the regime in his own rhetoric. He's become more of a hardliner himself. And I think he knows where the power is. He knows where the popular support is. And he wants to maintain his popular support. That's where he's headed. But the other reason I would say
Rouhani has always been a hardliner. He's not.
Well, so you say, look, not as hard as the guy, not as hard as the
hardliner.
Not as hard as the person he faced in the election that he won to become president.
He campaigned in 2013 and said a lot of things that were out of character for him because he was the national security advisor during the last great purges of the opposition and the moderates and reformers. But fair enough, he did. There was a moment, maybe a window, where he said, listen, I'd like to free more political prisoners. Not only has he not freed any of the political prisoners, and you know the leaders of the Green Movement remain to this day under house arrest.
Right.
There were more executions, state executions under Rouhani than anyone else. Saying, oh, but that's just the hard lines in the judiciary. But the point is that, yes, I agree. The presidency in Iran in a lot of cases is powerless. But at the same time, this is like the classic hustle. So I don't distinguish him, Zarif. They're all on the regime side. And as Shireen Ebadi told me a few months ago and when I interviewed her, she said the reform idea is over. And, you know, what she supports and many other activists support is a popular referendum on the powers of the supreme leader in the Iranian constitution.
Okay, let me finish.
Do you agree with me that you would support such a referendum at this point?
What's that?
You would support a referendum on the powers of the supreme leader, the Iranian constitution, to maybe have the UN Declaration of Human Rights as it, and have it, you know, really be a serious thing. And have
a referendum in Iran is fine with me, but I'm not willing to attack them if they don't do it or impose sanctions if they don't. I'd be happy if it happened, but if we applied either economic or military force to get all nations to do all the things that I would like to happen, it would be a pretty messy plan. Right.
Let's make it very clear, Mr. Hardcore, you know, I don't like the regime. I don't want to invade Iran. I'm against invading Iran. I'll say.
I'm against the economic pressure too. It's just not our right.
Well, I think I would argue that, like, I think I agree with you that sector-based sanctions that affect the entire economy. But I do think, you know, it's important to try to make the leaders of that regime as uncomfortable as possible.
Okay, but let me finish. Ask for one, it's not going to be a deal. I mean,
also in Russia, like, I want to try to really, you know, separate and make it very difficult for them to spend money abroad, travel abroad, send their kids to Western universities, that kind of thing.
Okay, can I finish making my case if there's going to be no deal? Okay, I'll tell you when I'm done.
All right.
I mean, first of all, the regime to even to do the minimal Trump wants, which is a renegotiated nuclear deal, to do it in the face of the kind of rhetoric and pressure you've gotten from Trump, given the fact that Iran stuck with the deal, for them to cave under this pressure would be such a huge loss of face domestically that on those grounds alone, it's almost certainly not going to happen. But beyond that, let me finish. Beyond that, we want all these other things. It sounds like you are not emphasizing as much, the restrictions on, their missiles, although they're not building missiles that violate any rules or treaties or anything. I mean, other countries get to develop ballistic missiles, but anyway, we think it's our right to say, no, you can't do that either. And we think it's our right to say, no, you can't have your troops or proxies in a country that has invited them in. We think it's a right to do that. In any event, Trump wants to, I think he wants to bring that into the deal. He wants them to cave on those fronts as well in terms of ballistic missiles or their behavior in Syria. And let me just quickly punctuate this to say, I'm sure you probably read and certainly disliked this piece I wrote for The Intercept, arguing, among other things, that Iran's behavior toward Israel can be seen as fundamentally a matter of deterrence and defensive posture, and the idea that they would launch some kind of unprovoked attack on Israel is probably wrong. Anyway, we can link to that piece, but that is relevant to this business of whether we should be telling them you've got to get your troops out of Syria, even though the Syrian government wants them. I mean, first of all, Syrian government sure doesn't want to lose them. It's still feeling pretty damn insecure, not surprisingly, given the fact that everyone around it tried to unseat it. So it wants the Iranians there. The Iranians want to be there. The idea, and then there's the human rights issues that I don't know if Trump plans to make them part of the negotiations. But I will say that these matters of its external behavior, you know, ballistic missiles, troops in Syria, Trump will be under a lot of pressure from Israel and Saudi Arabia to include those, because those are, to them, those are more important than the human rights thing in Iran, and in some ways as important as improving the nuclear deal. So Trump is just he's going to be asking for a ton of stuff, I think. Now he may just manage to paper. I don't think he's going to be able to paper over it the way he did in North Korea and get some kind of vague language and declare victory. And I think even there, it's going to slowly become clear that he didn't get much. But so I think there's going to be no deal. The regime is going to hunker down, probably survive. If necessary, they will brutally repress if there's a true insurrection. But in any event, I don't think they're going to negotiate a deal. And that's why I worry that, there actually could be a war. Because, you know, a lot of slippery slopes there, Yemen, a lot of things that could lead to conflict. But in any event, I don't think you need to worry about Trump actually reaching a deal with Iran.
If you don't want war in the Middle East, support democratic revolution in Iran.
So that was kind of the idea behind the Iraq invasion, right? We're going to empower Democrats.
The Iraq invasion was we're going to invade Iraq and rebuild it. And I don't think that that's realistic. What I do think is realistic is this is what is worked before in terms of these mm-hmm. transitioning dictatorships to democracy, and that are these people power movements, which are very hard to predict. But I do think that every time it comes back, and we are still in the middle of a spasm right now, mm-hmm. more and more people, it's more and more parts of the society. Even hardliners like Ahmadinejad has given really radicalized speeches and so forth in recent months. They never know when it's going to kind of come up again. And eventually, I mean, the strategy as I see it, is that, you know, there are still Iranians who comprise, you know, who make up the Basij, the national police, the army, and so forth. And it's about convincing those people that they don't have to follow the orders of, these sort of various thieves and fanatics who run the country. And I'm not giving you a timeline, but that's the way out of this kind of pickle, because I just don't think that the current leadership, and even after Khamenei dies, whoever is the next supreme leader or whatever they decide to do, I have not seen any kind of evidence that they will moderate a reform on their own. So I think you have to sort of support the idea of revolution.
I personally think that complete economic and technological engagement would be more likely to lead to what you and I both want to happen there, which is political liberalization. It's hard to say because we haven't done that. We haven't tried that. But that would be my.
Well, you have to figure out a way to do it without enriching. I mean, listen, the truth of the matter is that, you know, as Pompeo pointed out in his speech, and it's a powerful message that I understand has been translated into Farsi and so forth, it's a powerful message that these people who are at the top of these state institutions have become, you know, multimillionaires, in some cases billionaires, mm-hmm. and that, you know, the supreme leader controls this incredibly massive fund that's basically fueled and funded by the seizure of, you know, the homes of, you know, various Iranian citizens who can't. Yeah. And things like that. That really does resonate because they are rotten to a core. And they also, I think Iranian people more and more understand that all of the sanctions and all this other stuff, it's like their leaders are bringing it upon themselves because they're so driven by this aggressive.
This is always a problem when I was in Cuba not that long ago. And it's a problem there as they open up because, you know, the people who are already on top of the hierarchy are going to try to get a disproportionate share of the cut. And that's. It's a significant problem, but I still think Cuba, it's a better place and is better off by virtue of the engagement. That's my view.
Well, I think that it's not an either or. It's just you have to figure out a way to do it. The problem is that there was a lot of lazy thinking after the fall of the Soviet Union, which is that if we just open up markets and have more trade, then these authoritarian regimes will, over time, reform and become more like us. And that's not what has happened.
Well, no, although I would say both Russia and China are somewhat more politically pluralistic than they were during the Cold War.
Under Mao and
well, okay. So anyway, it got a little better. I mean, that's better than it getting worse or staying the same, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, also like
China's no democracy, but citizens, and God, China's doing a depressingly masterful job of using technologies that have the potential to decentralize political power to actually maintain their political power. And I'm sorry to see them doing such a good job of that. At the same time, it is more possible than it was under communism for groups of citizens to protest things, get things done.
They're creating an Orwellian thought-controlled state, which should terrify us.
They're trying, but they're not entirely succeeding. Anyway, you said you wanted to talk about Russia. You mean Helsinki or?
Well, really quick, because we're a bit over time, and I hope
the
listeners are still with us or the watchers are still with us. But
you'd be surprised. I just did a couple of hours with Michael Shermer, and we looked at the average watch times, and they are appreciably higher than if you do an hour.
Huh. All right. Well, I will ask, because I do have to run at some point, but I really wanted to get your perspective. Do you think that there was, and I include myself in the chorus of freak out about of Trump in Helsinki with Putin, that, you know, did you think that there was, that was a little bit unfair that, you know, he was trying to have some sort of personal relationship with him, and that Trump, do you believe that Trump is right when he says, you know, if I get along with Putin, it's a good thing. What's your view of that?
Well, as you know, I'm something of a realist. And so for example, with Iran, Russia is if your goal is to avoid war, Russia is a potentially constructive intermediary in with Iran right now. So, and I can see, a case for maintaining good relations. I thought the reaction was overblown, if in nothing else, a tactical sense. I've become more and more convinced that outrage actually helps Trump. And in this case, the poll numbers seem to show it. It was like there was unprecedented outrage, and it was unprecedentedly broad ideologically. Initially, it even infected Fox, but his approval rating rose. So I think, and I also just think, like, the whole performance is what you would expect from Trump. You know, somebody more articulate would have actually done much what he did and gotten in much less trouble. He would have kind of finessed the issue of, like, whether the Russians did it, but he wouldn't, you know, he's just a klutz in some ways. But I think, you know, I think the truth about Russia will probably come out. I think there's a real chance that we'll find not only collusion, but a quid pro quo, an explicit quid pro quo between the Trump campaign and maybe Trump himself with the Russians, whereby you guys help us with emails and so on, and we will do X, Y, and Z, maybe sanctions relief, maybe something in Syria. I'm giving that a higher probability than I used to. But in any event, I think...
By the way, no quo for the Russians.
What's that?
There's been no quo for the Russians.
So far, that's... well, actually, there's now some bill before...
The Trump administration's policy.
Well, right, of course.
Enigma, it's hard to explain, but... You know, I just
remember the resistances kind of harping on Russia has made it very hard politically for Trump to deliver any benefits to Russia. But even so, I mean, he ain't giving up. I mean, apparently there's a bill before Congress now that gives him some room to alleviate sanctions on Russia. And clearly he's still trying to work
until last year.
Yeah.
It was understood that any president could waive sanctions. In fact, we would not have had your cherished Iran deal had that not been the norm, that presidents can waive sanctions. It's part of their responsibility as the commander in chief and to make foreign policy. And even though I think Congress should assert its role in treaty making and war making, that right there is something that is pretty clear, that if the president wants to waive sanctions.
No, you're right. There hasn't been much in the way of quo. On the other hand, again, there's been huge political pressure on Trump not to deliver it. And he does seem to be keep kind of trying to bring the Russian regime into the realm of legitimacy. But I personally, my view is much too much emphasis has been placed on this. I think to call what he did treasonous is nuts and counterproductive. And there's been way too much, like, 1950s McCarthyite kind of hysteria about Trump and Russia. It's not productive. It's I think counter to liberal values in certain ways. It's xenophobic. It's this and it's that. And the truth will come out. We'll see. And as you know, I am partial to whataboutism. So I would point out that even in the worst case, even given what is pretty clear Russia did in our election, that's not qualitatively different from some stuff we've done in elections. And so on those grounds also, I would say, you know, there's a limit to how hysterical we should get.
And do you, I mean, I'm curious since we're, but do you think it's like calling yourself the resistance? I understand it's a brand and it's not, but like, isn't that, I say this as somebody, by the way, I'm more critical of Trump's embrace of Putin, I think, than you are on a lot of grounds. And I suspect you are.
I'm relatively non-critical.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but so, I mean, I, you know, but I just think if you're not, if there isn't a chance you're going to be captured, you don't get to call yourself a resistance. And this is the first resistance in the history of resistances to align itself with, you know, like the national security state.
Well, that's a, yeah. Well, you and your comrade in arms, Glenn Greenwald, are singing the same song here.
Well, I depart from Greenwald on a number of things. And
oh, really? I hadn't noticed that.
But see, Glenn and I disagree. But on this one, I just find it like, first of all, impeach the guy for something he's done as president. And if you want to impeach him, you're going to have to persuade Republicans. If you are in a resistance mode that we have to do whatever we can,
right?
You're not going to be able to accomplish your political aims of either defeating him in an election or impeaching him.
Now, it's probably unfortunate labeling.
And it's like kind of an insult to the history of resistance to call yourself a resistance when really you're just, it's just the branding of, you know, that you really, really don't like Trump and you think it's not normal. And I kind of agree with you that I think that one way to understand Brennan's sort of talk of him being a traitor and everything is that the Trump style of a kind of, you know, a lunge and hyperbole and this toxic rhetoric has infected his opposition in some degree as well. As often things happen in politics, which is that you have this one guy who, because that's what Trump does. Trump says, you know, the press are the enemy of the people. I hate that. I'm part of the press. That's disgusting. That's such a crazy over the top thing to say. But then it's like, you know, now we're getting this point where like, it's like Democrats are like, well, we got to fight fire with fire. And that you want to destroy norms. That's the way to do it.
No, I totally agree. If I'm ambivalent about the resistance branding, it's because I have, in one sense, bought into it. You know, after I developed this idea that the resistance was overdoing it on several fronts in a counterproductive way, I started this thing called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter. I wrote a piece, you know, partly because I'd written this book on meditation, but I also meant the word mindful just in a plain English sense of like, sure, resist, but do it carefully, deliberately, mindfully. And so I've now got this brand. I mean, the newsletter is on summer hiatus, but people, it'll be back in September. Right. People can subscribe.
I'll subscribe to that.
It's mindful resistance.
I've started like finally in my 40s to like understand the value of meditation too, which I think is.
You're meditating?
I'm really just beginning. In fact, I'll read what you've written about. I'll get your book and read it because I find it
you
is.
You should read my book, Eli.
Yeah, I will.
It will, by the end of it, you will be not only calmer, but a big fan of international law.
No,
I don't think you will, but you'll be calmer.
I want to be calmer, but I was in the last part. No.
No, yeah. Don't worry. I don't mention international law I went a whole book about Buddhism without once mentioning international law. So wait, was there one more thing I want to? Oh, anyway,
we got our big perennial disagreement out of the way, and now we're sort of in like approaching.
We're buddies again, man.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you're going to sign up,
can I ask you a final question on this, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, my final question to you is: Do you fear that we are really on the verge of transitioning out of being a republic and into something more authoritarian? I hate using the word fascist because it does have such a historical connotation.
Yeah.
But do you think that we're in danger of losing our constitutional republic at this point?
I wouldn't put the danger very high. I would say Trump is the kind of guy who would take what he would get. He could get.
Yeah, I think that's right.
He doesn't even understand where the bright lines are that he would be crossing. He doesn't care anyway. He would do pretty much anything. So he is himself a potential authoritarian. I think you'd agree that the Republicans have not been altogether inspiring in the way they have reacted to some of his norm violation. Maybe wouldn't, but that's a source of concern. That said, I'm not putting the chance of losing the republic at over, you know, 30% or anything right now. I mean,
Albright and Tim Snyder, and Tim Snyder is one of my favorite authors, but maybe they're over-torquing it a bit.
I think there's a little of that, and I also think there's the danger in getting so overwrought that you wind up playing into his hands, which I think we agree is to some extent happened.
Right.
So people can sign up for that newsletter at mindfulresistance.net. They can follow you on Twitter at, not surprisingly, at Eli Lake, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what I struggle with is that I have written pieces that have been kind of critical of the same things that we agree that we're critical of on the resistance side, some of the neo-McCarthyism and things like that. But recently, I just feel that, you know, he's the president and you need to focus on the main thing. So, Democrats are out of power right now. And I do think that in American politics, we afford a little bit of leeway to the party that's out of power. So, you know, I did not spend a lot of time tracking down birthers in the Obama years, in part because I was like, well, Obama's the president, and the leaders of the Republican Party don't buy any of that crap. And then we got a birther as president. But I'm just saying that it's sort of like, I feel that now we're 1.5 years in, Trump's the president, you got to focus on Trump, and you can't just kind of take this view that, you know, I'm going to be the voice that, you know, I mean, you should probably criticize both, but that's what I struggle with. And then when I saw, and the Helsinki thing, I didn't like the Singapore summit either. And I don't like it when, and I'll just leave it on this because you'll see, I'm really just a softie. I really despise the fact that he riles up Americans against, you know, what are largely very hardworking Latino people who, you know, who are here working in our kitchens and things like that. And like the vast majority of them, very many years ago when I just got out of college, I worked in a restaurant. You guys are like, you know, going to be great Americans.
Totally.
And it's like he is usually, we just took it for granted that the president, you know, George W. Bush after 9/11 went to an Islamic center and said, Islam is a religion of peace, which was, you know, important. So you didn't want to have the president like riling up
right.
just venom in the population. And that is something that Trump does. And MS-13, and you can find they are a brutal organization. They're very bad. They are not the kind of threat that Al-Qaeda was. Or so by emphasizing, making this big thing and like saying, I'm going to talk about this. It is in a way making, I think, very difficult, particularly for Latinos in America, which I really, that is something that's pretty awful when it's coming from the president of the United States. We always, you know, there's always going to be senators and lawmakers. You know what I mean? There's always going to be, you're going to find somebody who gets elected who's going to kind of, you know, talk like that kind of brash George Wallace.
Yeah, I mean, he naturally appeals to, almost instinctively appeals to the worst in human nature.
That's bad.
The xenophobia, the bigotry, but to get back to the sometimes excessive volume of the resistance, I think it makes it even, to the extent that he fears actual impeachment, it gets actually even worse because he says, well, to avoid impeachment, forget about winning election, I gotta hang on to my base. And that'll keep us from any kind of 2/3 majority in a Senate that could convict me. And so I think, you know, I wouldn't be sorry to see him successfully impeached, but I don't think it's going to happen unless what Mueller uncovers is even more egregious than I imagine. And, so I think given that, you know, kind of harping on impeachment, in a way plays into his hands. It brings out the worst in him, but you're right. It's horrible. And what's also horrible is the way you lose track of it. It gets normalized. You know, it's like you just expect him to say these things about Latinos or about Muslims or whatever else. And,
because I think that if you ever worked in a restaurant, the guys who were like the dishwasher, those are the most vulnerable. Those are vulnerable Americans. And it's like, there's something really kind of, there's really something sinister about it to use it as a political ploy to keep your base. And I think there's a lot of Trump voters who aren't necessarily defined by them. Of course, there are, you know, the very high profile people who like Trump for all the reasons that you and I hate it. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of people who voted for Trump, maybe for the Supreme Court justices. I like to believe that is not a majority of Americans or even a majority of Republicans. And and you take it for granted that there were Republican nominees, Republican leaders, people like Mitt Romney and John McCain who would never do anything like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I'd like to get back to that.
And look, nations have a right to control their borders. I mean, I think a wall is like a symbolically horrible thing. But the idea that you could have a less permissive immigration system wouldn't by itself kill me, as long as it weren't some kind of like ethnically biased or various other things. But I mean, the idea of controlling borders, that doesn't kill me, but you don't have to use this kind of rhetoric to take that position. So.
Right. And I do think that there's an element of it where it's like MS-13 is in some ways like really an example of threat inflation. You and I would disagree about threat inflation. Like, I think Iran is a real threat. You don't. But I think that like the MS-13 thing is, they were a much bigger problem like 10 years ago anyway, right?
It's not only that. It gets into, he's used them to use the word animals in a way that is ambiguous. So like, he'll mention MS-13 and then he won't mention them for a sentence and then he'll say they're animals and everybody will go, you just called all Latinos animals. And he'll say, you can read this in a way where I didn't. So anyway, the truth.
Yeah, it's like that kind of thing. And it's like, don't keep us in suspense. We're even having that conversation is so disgusting. It's terrible, right? And it's like, that's the part of it. Like, cause I'm a big believer in like the E pluribus unum that we're big. But when we're at our best, America is at its best. We're like a melting pot. We borrow from other cultures, and you kind of, to be an American is to, you know, have many different threads and everything like that. And it's like this. So in a lot of ways, I find that that impulse, even though it is, there is a history of it in America, is un-American, at least the ideal American that I like.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is good. We did end on a note of comedy.
We did end on a note of concord. You're going to have the mindful resistance tattoo put on your arm, which is good. you're going to buy my book and give it as gifts to people for the rest of your life. That's good.
Put it up on the screen. Let me see it and I'll order it.
You want to see
the meditation one. That's the
right. Oh no, I know what I'll do.
That's powerful stuff.
Here you go. Oh, whoops. That's the French version.
Oh, fabulous. Wow. Why is that the one why Buddhism?
What's that?
What is the name of it? Why Buddhism?
Why Buddhism is True.
Okay. Wow. That's a.
I know. It worked sales wise. I know it's annoying. And also during the more heated moments of our conversation, I think we should emphasize that whatever either of us may have said, neither of us is a terrible person.
Oh, yeah. But that's obvious. We've been doing this now for quite some time.
You never know. People may take something out of context, like that thing I'm going to take out of context that you said, for example.
Right. No, but I mean, like, we've been doing it for a while, and this is one of the reasons I've been the Blogging Heads for a while. I come back, you know, less frequently now, but one of the reasons this is such an important thing, especially in these times, is that, you know, it's important for people who disagree, you know, with integrity to debate. It's like, why can't we do that?
Totally. That's what Blogging Heads is
very unresistance or un-MAGA thing that we're doing right now.
Now, you have long been an important contributor to this this atmosphere of honest, frank, and yes, sometimes heated dialogue.
Right. All right.
But we always end as friends. Sometimes it's actually ended on a slightly more heated note than this, but never, you know. True animosity.
This was really good. I'm glad we did this. And I thought it was, I hope the viewers and the listeners like it.
Okay. So we should do this at least once a year, if not more frequently.
Yeah, we should do it. I agree. When something comes up.
You've committed to that. Okay, good.
Good.
All right. Take care, Eli.
Thanks. You're going to push.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to. And we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.